The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today, I'm honored to be joined by one of the most eminent and leading national and international researchers in the field of Alzheimer's disease, Dr. James Law. During his illustrious career, Dr. Law has led basic laboratory research efforts and the development of a multidisciplinary team devoted to the care of patients with Alzheimer's and other degenerative brain diseases. He is currently Associate Professor of Neurology at Emory University, where he serves as Director of Emory's Cognitive Neurology Program, Vice Chair of Neurology, and Clinical Core Leader of the NIH-funded Emory Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. He is also the principal investigator of the Emory Healthy Aging Study, the largest clinical research study in Atlanta. Dr. Law has received national and international recognition for his leadership in Alzheimer's research, has published over 100 journal articles, and is the appointed Alice and Roy Richards Endowed Chair for Alzheimer's Disease. Dr. Law, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Sharon. Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Law, Alzheimer's disease is currently ranked as the sixth leading cause of death in the United States, and it's the most common cause of dementia. And many of my patients, as I'm sure yours, really are concerned about ways, especially if they have it in their family, that they can prevent Alzheimer's disease, early ways that they can catch it earlier, and if there are any cures on the horizon. So hopefully we can get to all of these topics today. Let me start by asking you, what do we know about the cause of Alzheimer's? What puts people at risk for getting it?
So that's a wonderful place to start, and maybe even taking one step back. One of the most common questions that we get when we do talks to really almost any audience, even medical audiences, is sort of clarifying what the difference is between Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And so what I try to explain is dementia is really just a description of symptoms. So it would be like saying, I have a headache, but my head might hurt because I have an aneurysm that's about to rupture, or I happen to be Tiger Woods and my wife took a golf club upside my head. Both of those can cause my head to hurt. But just saying I have a headache doesn't explain why my head hurts. So when one says that one has dementia or dementia symptoms, it implies that there has been a loss of ability, memory, and other higher thinking abilities that have progressed to a point where it's interfering with normal abilities. And that's basically all that means. And there are many different diseases that can cause dementia. Alzheimer's disease is just the most common in older adults. And so that's why people tend to confuse Alzheimer's disease and dementia. So what causes Alzheimer's disease is believe it or not, still an active area of investigation. We know that the single most important cause of Alzheimer's disease in terms of driving risk factors is simply living longer. And so we have very few patients, fortunately, who have Alzheimer's disease when they're in their 40s. But by the time people get into their 80s, it becomes incredibly common. And so aging in and of itself is a major driver for Alzheimer's disease. And then we know that there are changes that occur inside the brain that that we can see either at autopsy or using specialized tools. We can see evidence of changes inside the brain, and the underlying drivers for those changes may be genetic, environmental, experience, exposures, and perhaps even certain types of medications, lifestyle choices that all contribute to the development of Alzheimer's disease in some people. So it's very complex. There are both genetic factors that we can't control, and lifestyle and environmental factors that we can control to some extent that all contribute.
Yeah, and this will really tie into maybe things that people can do for prevention, because as you mentioned, some of the genetic factors we can't really control. some of the associations are with some chronic diseases, and those, of course, are linked to lifestyle. Can you maybe talk about some of the things that people who are concerned about Alzheimer's can do to reduce their risk?
Yeah, there was actually a nice report that came out of Great Britain about a year ago, sort of outlining modifiable risk factors that, and what proportion of Alzheimer's disease might be prevented by influencing lifestyles. And one of the keys is that it has to start early. I know you've been a big proponent of healthy lifestyle choices. And all of the epidemiologic data really suggests that in order to impact your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease in your 70s and 80s, the linkages tend to be with choices that people make, what they do much younger. So in their 30s and 40s, even before that, because the impact of educational attainment has a significant impact on the risk of Alzheimer's disease. So those who have lesser educational attainment, so high school or less, are actually at substantially greater risk of developing Alzheimer's disease than those who have a college degree. So, and you know, is that directly as a consequence of the education? Maybe, maybe not. It may be that the education serves as a sort of a proxy marker for what you're likely to do in terms of occupation. And so if you have a more mentally challenging occupation and you use more of your cognitive abilities during life, during your working years, that may help in some way to reduce your risk.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that a lot of what we term old age diseases really have their root in childhood. And I think if we do look at the perspective of diseases as occurring throughout a lifetime, really, and us just seeing the disease manifest late in life, it really changes the perspective of our opportunities to intervene and maybe be a little more proactive when we're in middle age or even younger, even as children. And, you know, general healthy lifestyle, as you mentioned, would be helpful. So things that people can do would be maybe if they didn't necessarily pursue higher education, lifelong learning at any point, just continual learning, whether it's hobbies, if it's not channeled towards their occupation, still would be beneficial in building their reserve as they go into their later years.
Absolutely. In fact, one of my favorite studies, I think, came out of the Long Island study of aging, and it was reported. And this is a pretty old study now, but it was reported in the New England Journal a number of years ago, and it listed leisure activities and avocational interests that were associated with either increased or decreased risk of developing dementia in later life. And so the activities that tend to be protective are things like people who read a lot, people who play musical instruments. Ballroom dancing turned out to be a significantly good association.
It's hard work. You got to think about it.
You got to think about it. That's right. It requires you. Plus, it involves some physical activity. But I always like that study because one of the activities that was associated with no protection, and none of the guys like this, but golf provided zero protection. So
I thought when you said none of the guys liked it, you were going to say something else.
Yeah. I'm not asking.
But not golf. Yeah. And, you know, and on the note of what doesn't work, you know, there's a whole market out for brain games. And you probably have some thoughts about that as well.
Yeah, they tend to allow you to perform better at those games, but it doesn't tend to extend further out. And as long as you've brought up the subject, it's been a bit of a sore point for me because there are folks out there who are claiming that they have formulas either based on activities or customized supplements or whatever that will help you reverse or completely prevent or fix your Alzheimer's disease or other degenerative brain diseases. And Those bother me because, in my mind, they're people who are taking advantage of desperate individuals who are hoping for something and promising something that they just cannot deliver. And so there is nothing like that once people are symptomatic. But doing those positive activities, you know, we've been talking about sort of mentally stimulating and socially engaging kinds of things, but also aerobic exercise, lifestyle choices in terms of diet, social engagement. These are all very positive things that when cultivated early or late, I don't think it's ever too late, can have a beneficial effect. It's a very difficult thing to prove, but the epidemiology is pretty compelling that there is an important impact of lifestyle choices on risk of dementias in later life.
Yeah, and in terms of diet, you know, the MIND diet has received a lot of attention, and I believe it was about a 53% reduction in the 4.5 years that they followed people. The impact of lifestyle, I guess the question is, how impactful is it relative to the genetics?
The truth is that genetics is an enormously powerful driver for Alzheimer's disease. But as you said earlier, there's not much we can do. I mean, I do recommend that people take great care in selecting their parents. But if you make a mistake in that first selection, you don't really have a lot of choices in manipulating that. So there is a great heritability. And so people who have a parent or a sibling, a first-degree relative who has Alzheimer's disease, the relative increase in risk, the estimates vary, but it's quite substantial. And ultimately, I think that the unmodifiable genetic factors probably play a much bigger impact than we would like. I'm not going to give it a number, but it is the truth is that those unmodifiable factors play a very powerful role in sort of determining your overall risk. But that's something that we can talk about in terms of prevention, and that's where I think medicine and preventive medicine comes in. But for people who are thinking about lifestyles and healthy choices, it is important to note that perhaps a third of the risk is in some way modifiable based on lifestyle choices and activities. And so we want people to focus on those. And people who have coexisting conditions like hypertension, diabetes, those can have an impact because they interact with Alzheimer's disease, perhaps to accelerate the development of the Alzheimer's changes, but also completely independently of the Alzheimer's pathology, having an additive effect in terms of cognitive decline as we get older. So paying attention to those things can have a big impact in reducing the overall burden.
Yeah, and to your point, you know, even if someone has a high predisposition based on genetics, if their lifestyle and their ability to build their cognitive reserve can delay the onset, since this is an old age disease, they may never actually develop the disease. So if people could put off Alzheimer's by 5 years, I think the rate of Alzheimer's would be cut in half. By 2050.
Yep. Correct? So yeah. Actually, that reminds me of a couple of patients that I always think of when this issue comes up. So many years ago, I saw a patient who was probably in his middle 80s, and he had come to me with some memory concerns. And sure enough, he did have some memory concerns. They were mild. At the time, we had diagnosed him with mild cognitive impairment. But the kicker is that he had an identical twin who had died of advanced Alzheimer's disease more than 10 years earlier. And then I had another more recent episode, slightly younger, but a fellow in his early 70s who came to see me. And he was already, he already had significant impairments. He had some mild to moderate dementia symptoms from Alzheimer's. And he was brought to see me by his identical twin. And these two had not weighed more than 5 pounds different their entire lives. They still looked like carbon copies. And so in those sorts of instances, we know that the genetic background is exactly the same. Many of the environmental influences are very similar. And yet, in the first case, this was a guy who developed symptoms probably at least 15 years after his identical twin. And I don't know when the healthy brother might have ever developed symptoms, but he was still perfectly healthy while his brother had been sick already for several years. So those are good examples of sort of real-life anecdotes where we know that in some sort of environmental influence or factor had a big impact on these two sets of identical twins.
Yeah, those are great examples. And on the note of family members bringing people in, you know, a lot of people who are predisposed or have Alzheimer's in their family, at the first sign of any change in memory, of course, the concern and the fear comes that this could be the start of dementia. Yet there are also a lot of perfectly normal age-related changes that happen in memory. I guess in terms of, and this is a two-part question, but are there some telltale signs, symptoms people should look out for? And then are there good ways to diagnose Alzheimer's at an early stage?
Yeah, those are great questions, and it's a concern that comes up. There's not a simple answer because one of the challenges to early recognition of somebody who's developing memory loss or cognitive decline from whatever source is the very earliest changes that we might see are often very hard to discriminate from normal aging-related changes. So we not you, but those of us who are older than you will start to experience things like having trouble recalling people's names or you know, other lapses. And those do tend to happen more commonly. And it's probably the single most common cognitive complaint among middle-aged and older adults. And so when those sort of lapses occur, some people will get very upset about them, but in and of themselves, they may or may not signify something important. I think one of the ways that you can sort of benchmark things is diseases that are degenerative, meaning progressively worsening over time, like Alzheimer's disease, by definition, get worse over time. So if another example, I get lost all the time. In fact, I went to the wrong building on my way to come to the interview today. And I've done this. I've lived in Atlanta for over 20 years, and I still get lost on a regular basis. So when I'm 80 and I'm getting lost, you can't necessarily hold that against me. But if I'm getting lost even more and increasingly become disoriented, or if my lapses in memory are just not occasional, but they become more frequent or spill over into other areas and you see worsening, those are indications that that maybe there is something more significantly amiss. And even there, it's difficult because if it's somebody that you live with, if it's your spouse, and you see that person every day, seeing those changes kind of as they gradually sneak up on you may be difficult. But children, especially, you know, if they're children who live a distance away and they see their parents a few times a year, they're much more likely to notice significant changes across time. So worsening of those lapses is one thing that that is more concerning for a degenerative process. I think your other question had to do with early detection. So that's a favorite topic of mine. There is now, we know from the work that's been done over the last 20 years or so, pretty convincingly, that the pathology of Alzheimer's disease, the changes that we see in a person's brain after they've died, if we look at their brains at autopsy, those changes are starting to settle into the brain 20 years or more before a person is actually diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. So that means really we should not view Alzheimer's disease as being any different from any other chronic disease. And the way that we currently are managing things would be if a cardiologist said, you know, I know I see this blockage in your left anterior descending coronary artery, but, you know, it's only about 90% blocked. Let's leave it alone until it gets a little bit farther. And that buildup has occurred over many, many, many years. And the buildup of the Alzheimer's pathology is occurring over many, many, many years. But just like the blockages in the coronary arteries don't cause chest pain or other problems until it reaches a critical point, the pathology of Alzheimer's disease progresses to a point, a critical point where it causes symptoms. But that process is a 20-year process. And we've come a long way. We can determine the presence of Alzheimer's disease pretty conclusively in life. People used to say you couldn't be sure until somebody was dead and you look at their brain under a microscope. But now, by using tests looking at the spinal fluid or advanced imaging tools, we can actually say unequivocally that a person is having early memory symptoms because of Alzheimer's disease. And that is really the key to prevention, because we can detect the presence of pathology up to 20 years before somebody actually develops symptoms. And people who have very mild symptoms, this very mild cognitive impairment pre-dementia stage, we can determine definitively whether that's due to Alzheimer's disease or not. And if it is due to Alzheimer's disease, this person who has very mild symptoms has a very high probability, almost 100% probability, of progressing to mild Alzheimer's disease inside of a 5-year window. Whereas if the test for the Alzheimer's pathology is negative, that risk of progression to dementia over the next 5 years is less than 10%. So we've come a long way in terms of early detection. That's one of the things that we do very well at centers like ours. Unfortunately, for most people, they don't have easy access to specialized centers where they do a lot of early diagnostics.
And speaking of people not having access to the resources of an academic medical center, you know, there are a lot of people who see their doctor, have memory problems, probably do have Alzheimer's, but are not diagnosed and miss that window maybe when they could potentially plan their life differently, get on some treatments. And I know you're involved with a larger project, the Georgia Alzheimer's Project. And what are the goals that you have for that project?
Yeah, as you say, that's exactly right. It's a some of the numbers are pretty startling. The explicit discussion about diagnosis, about the underlying cause for memory loss, that conversation happens pretty rarely in normal medical care. So people may their doctors may tell them, yeah, you're definitely experiencing some memory loss, or I think you have some mild dementia symptoms. But they very seldom have an explicit discussion about you're experiencing symptoms of early or moderate or late Alzheimer's disease. And there are many reasons for that. But up to 80% of people in Georgia who experience memory loss and dementia symptoms never get a specific diagnosis of Alzheimer's or Lewy body or frontotemporal or vascular or whatever cause for their dementia. And so the goal for the Georgia Alzheimer's Project is to develop something called the Georgia Memory Net. And what we're endeavoring to do in that project is set up regional centers around the state. So we've set up 5 centers in Columbus, Albany, Macon, Augusta, and one in Atlanta. And the idea is that we're going to train staff and physicians, providers at each of those sites to function in a highly specialized manner like we do. It's going to take some time to complete that training, but each of those regions will have a memory assessment clinic where they can get the same kind of expertise. And at the same time, we're developing a resource to link patients and families with community resources after they go back home to help provide support for the management of those individuals so that they can do things like, you know, have contacts to help manage behavioral problems, avoid unnecessary emergency room visits, prevent premature placement into assisted living or skilled nursing facilities. And then Another part that we're working with you and others in primary care to develop is the extension of educational activities to primary care physicians throughout the state to promote earlier recognition and then appropriate referral of patients to these regional memory assessment clinics so that we can improve the entire infrastructure. So that's the goal for that project. And the intervention, so you know, one of the things, I don't like to try and scare people, but one of the things that I tell providers to get their attention is if you don't make a specific diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or frontotemporal dementia or Lewy body dementia today, it's not truly not that big of a deal because the treatments that we have today are woefully inadequate for the challenges of those diseases. But the progress that's happening right now in the Alzheimer's disease space means that there is a very high likelihood that within the next several years, there will be a drug that proves to be effective at slowing down the progression of Alzheimer's disease. But the secondary prediction that I'll make is that that drug will prove to be effective only if applied very early in the course of disease. So whereas now it may not make a huge difference, a few years from now, certainly 10 years from now, if the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease is delayed until somebody's already moderately demented, the drugs that become available that are effective may no longer be effective for that person. So the early recognition, the Georgia Alzheimer's Project, the work that we do throughout our educational activities, our outreach to primary care, all of that is targeted at helping people understand the importance of early diagnosis, and that will only become more important in the years to come than it is today. And even today, what you said, the very important things about providing support, planning, contingency planning, keeping people out of trouble, helping them avoid financial disasters, those are not trivial benefits for early diagnosis today. But in the future, it will become medically really imperative that diagnosis be made early.
And, you know, there's a lot of speculation, you know, that there's been a substantial investment in Alzheimer's cures or treatments, and we're kind of approaching it when the horse is already out of the barn, and it's a very end stage of the disease by the time people develop even the first sign of symptoms, which is not necessarily intuitive in how we see symptoms and where people are in their disease state. And a lot of, you know, the treatments that haven't been successful were targeting amyloid. Can you talk a little bit about the newer treatment options that are in the pipeline that you think are going to be disease modifying? How are they different? What are the targets?
So you're absolutely right again that the anti-amyloid treatments have been the focus, almost the exclusive focus of drug development in the last 10, 15 years. And I think there's still a hope for that approach as a prevention or a disease-modifying therapy if applied early enough. The other targets, the anti-amyloid is targeting, of course, one of the main pathologies in Alzheimer's, the amyloid plaques. But there's a second pathology that's universally present in Alzheimer's patients, and that's something called tau, the Greek letter tau, T-A-U, or tangles. And it turns out that that pathology, again, evolves fairly early and may be present for many years before somebody develops symptoms, but it's probably a little bit later in development than amyloid pathology is. And it turns out that treatments targeting tau in preclinical studies have looked very promising. So just as we can eliminate the amyloid pathology from people's brains, we can eliminate the tau pathology, we think, from people's brains. And that may be an approach that provides another approach to providing prevention or disease-modifying therapy that may be more effective even a little bit later in the course of disease. And then there is a lot of new target development, new treatment target development that really is looking at inflammation People don't often think about degenerative brain disease as an inflammatory condition like, you know, rheumatoid arthritis or things along those lines. But it turns out that inflammation inside the brain is really emerging as a very important aspect of disease progression. And so they're in development still, but I suspect that very soon we'll see a whole host of target drugs that target inflammatory mechanisms as another strategy. So, you know, the National Alzheimer's Plan that was signed into law by Barack Obama in 2011, one of the hallmarks of that was to develop an effective therapy treatment for Alzheimer's disease by 2025. Well, 2025 is right around the corner, but I'm reasonably optimistic that by 2025 there will be a drug or more than one that has proven the ability to delay or slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease. So things are moving forward quickly, and we're not there yet, but I think there's a lot more reason for optimism than there was 15 to 20 years ago.
And you are currently leading the Emory Healthy Aging Study, which is the largest research study in Atlanta. And one of the main goals of that study is to find an earlier stage, an earlier sign or symptom, and to find new ways of treating Alzheimer's. Right. What are the specific goals in how does the study work?
So we talked about how long the pathology of Alzheimer's disease is sort of brewing in people's brains before they develop symptoms. But as you alluded earlier to the fact that we have many people who die who are perfectly normal, if they've donated their brains for research, we look at their brains and we in fact find that they have extensive Alzheimer's pathology, but they never developed any symptoms. And that raises the question, well, if that person had lived 5 years longer, would he or she have developed symptoms? What about 10 years? Would he or she have developed symptoms? If she had lived 20 years longer, would she have developed symptoms? And the answer is we just don't know. Right now, I can do a test and determine whether or not a healthy 50-year-old or a healthy 60-year-old has evidence of Alzheimer's pathology in his or her brain. What I can't do is say, okay, pathology is present. Now, when is this person going to get in trouble? So a predictive marker, because as these treatments, these disease-modifying treatments become available, they're probably not going to be without risk. Some of these have significant risks. And so I want to be able to do a screening test in everybody. So, you know, we turn 50 and we delay getting our colonoscopy, even though it's recommended for many of us as a screening for colon cancer, because if you do that and there's a polyp and it's snipped out, you're fine. I look forward to a day when people will, at the age of 50 or 55 or 60, get a screening test for Alzheimer's disease to determine if they are at risk. And then in order to decide when or if that person should be treated with one of these available drugs, we have to predict when they're going to get in trouble. So if you're 50 years old, you have pathology, and I can reasonably predict that you're going to develop symptoms in 10 to 15 years, I should go ahead and start treating you. If you're 80 years old and you have evidence of pathology and there's an indication that you're going to develop symptoms in 10 to 15 years down the road, I should leave you alone. And so that's the primary goal. So for the Healthy Aging Study, there's a cohort that is an incredible cohort of volunteers. So these are middle-aged folks, mostly between 50 and 70, maybe up to 75, who are all cognitively normal. And they volunteer to come in, do a whole series of paper and pencil tests, which make everybody feel terrible. But they do that to kind of let us assess their cognition. We collect blood. They have a whole host of cardiovascular measures. They undergo lumbar puncture. They donate spinal fluid. And they have brain imaging. And through these various measures, we can determine which of these individuals may be at greater risk of developing Alzheimer's disease down the road. And importantly, we then can follow those individuals. They come back every 2 years to do this entire battery. And we can try and identify markers that will predict when or if somebody's going to develop a problem. So as these treatments come along, we can apply them appropriately and time the application of the drugs appropriately. So that's sort of the overarching goal of the Healthy Brain Study component of the Emory Healthy Aging Study. But then the larger study, so that the Healthy Brain Study portion of it currently has, I think we're approaching about 700 participants who've come in for these sort of 6.5, 7-hour visits. But the Emory Healthy Aging Study is much broader, much easier, and it's designed to engage as large a cohort of individuals as we can who agree to provide some information online. The questionnaire, I think, is about 20, 22 minutes. And they agree to be contacted about maybe other surveys or questions so that when Dr. Berquist wants to do a survey of 5,000 individuals between ages of 20 and 40 for what sort of dietary habits they might be cultivating, this is a cohort that we can reach out to collect information like that and then maybe compare that to information in their medical records or comorbidities, you know, blood test results, things that we can use to study the process of healthy aging and the associations between things that promote healthy aging, not just in terms of brain health, but in terms of cardiovascular health, skin health, joint health, really almost anything that people might have interest in studying. So the Healthy Aging Study we're excited about because we think it's going to be an incredible resource for everybody. We want people to take advantage of the cohort. We want people to take advantage of the data that's being collected and seed additional ideas and promote new projects.
And both of these studies, the Healthy Brain and the Healthy Aging Study, are still open to taking new people who want to participate. And we will have available as part of the podcast notes, the website and phone number for anybody who's interested in participating. And for people who do willingly give their time, what is the advantage for participants to be part of these studies?
So that's, we need to do a sort of a rigorous survey of our participants. I can tell you that the primary motivation of people who do this, and really, I mean, if you think about it, these are people who are generally still working. They come and they spend literally all day with us, so they have to get a day off from work or give up a day of vacation or whatever to do this. And they get we provide some, you know, modest compensation for travel and things like that. But they do it because they're motivated to help. Oftentimes, for the folks who are involved in the Healthy Brain Study, it's because they've had a loved one or a close friend, a family member who has suffered from Alzheimer's or some related disease, so they want to contribute. And so I think the primary motivation really is really incredibly altruistic, and it's really gratifying to see how willing people are to do something like this. What I hope will be a secondary benefit, though, and I haven't really talked about this a lot, but as we move forward, this is a group of individuals that we are going to know intimately. We're going to see them every 2 years. We're going to know all about their medical history. We're going to know about their risks. And this is a group that I think would be a perfect group to offer potential interventions as they come along. So right now, I don't have much to offer for somebody who's 50 or 55 years old, but we already have prevention trials for Alzheimer's disease for people who are 65 and 70 who have no symptoms but have evidence of pathology. As those trials sort of move along, I want to be able to offer these 50 and 55 and 60-year-olds the opportunity to get involved in intervention trials that may help prevent them ever getting sick. As treatments become available and are proven, we can provide the information that we collect as part of that study to go into their decision-making once it becomes medically relevant. So the people who participate really do for the most benevolent, altruistic reasons. But I hope that they will get benefit. They will certainly benefit others and their children and their younger siblings, but I hope that it will ultimately benefit them personally as the field moves forward and we can use the information to help promote their sustained well-being.
Dr. Lau, thank you so much. Thank you for all the work that you do, the contribution you make to the field of Alzheimer's, the way you impact your patients on a day-to-day basis. Are there any words that you want to share, any thoughts with people listening to this podcast about dementia or any words of advice that you have?
You know, I think the only thing that I would encourage is one of the things that that I try and do is to give an optimistic. I try not to be Pollyanna-ish about it, but I want to be optimistic because I believe that there is reason for optimism. And one thing that holds everything back and delays recognition, evaluation is fear. And so the one thing that I guess I'd like to say is that, yes, that it's a serious challenge. It's a big problem. We don't have a fix for it yet. But there is good reason and good reason to seek evaluation as early as possible with significant benefits. And there may be increasingly as time moves forward, increasingly important reasons to recognize these things. So the more people are able to talk about and sort of share concerns, but also recognize that there is important advances being made and that there is hope for optimism, I hope that this will become a less fearful situation and people will be more proactive in approaching it.
Yeah, I love that. As an optimist, I completely appreciate that. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, it was a pleasure being here, Sharon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.